Welcome to Ideas and Issues. This is Hugh LaFollette, your host. My guest this morning is Dale Martin, professor of religion at Duke University, and our topic is homosexuality in the Bible. Dale, glad to have you with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I wonder if you could begin the show by giving us sort of your overall view, your overall understanding of the biblical view of homosexuality, and then we'll look at the components of that view in more detail.
Okay, probably I should just say right out front that I think it's misleading to talk about the biblical view of homosexuality for a variety of reasons. For one thing, it makes the Bible sound like a person, that it's a person who has a view. And the Bible is actually a collection of documents that stretches thousands and thousands of years, and it's lots of different documents written by different people. Even for people who believe that the whole Bible is the inspiration of God, and so that it all has something of a unity, the Bible still is a collection of documents. And so that's one reason I think it's just misleading. The other thing is that the Bible says very, very little anywhere in it about same-sex sex. Jesus never mentions it. In fact, Jesus, a lot of people don't seem to recognize that Jesus almost never says anything about sex at all. Just didn't seem to have been important. So we don't find any references to homosexuality in the Gospels. And in fact, in all of the New Testament, the only place it occurs is one place in Paul's letter to the Romans. And some people would say that in a couple of lists of sins, one place in 1 Corinthians 6:9 and 1 Timothy 1:10, there are some Greek terms that some people want to translate as homosexual. There again, other scholars would say those are mistranslations. In the Old Testament of the Hebrew Bible, there is only a reference to a man lying with a man as like a woman in Leviticus 18:22 and perhaps one other reference, I think maybe in Exodus. So, out of all the possible places in the Bible where someone could go to find out something about homosexuality, there are very, very few, and even those few are very much disputed. They're ambiguous, and different scholars, some scholars will say, we're not talking there about homosexuality in anything like the modern sense of the term. So there are lots of different reasons that I would just say that it's misleading to talk about the biblical view of homosexuality in the first place.
Okay, so I've invited you to talk on the show about something that, in some sense, is a mistake.
That's yeah, okay. Well, that's the way our questions about religion usually start off with, don't they?
And that may well be true. All right, the two principal components that you just mentioned that I would like to elaborate, I suspect we'll spend more time in the second, but the first seems worthwhile. By your account, Jesus, the central figure in Christianity, never mentions homosexuality. That at most, as you described it, there are three verses in the New Testament which, at least by some account, make reference to homosexuality, and perhaps two in the Old Testament.
Right.
So that, generously speaking, there are five references, all of them short and none by Jesus.
Right.
What inference should we draw from that, if any?
I think the first thing is, there's lots of inferences. One of the things is that an inference is that people who want to act like homosexuality is some great important sin, ranking up there with, murder or something like that, they're really blowing things out of proportion. I think that's one thing you just have to say. For another thing, I think we have to recognize that homosexuality is a very important social question right now for people, but the way we think of homosexuality, may not have existed in the ancient world, and so it's. I don't think it's surprising that we find so few references to it in the Bible. I think it's because it wasn't as big an issue for people then as it is for people now.
Do you have any idea why?
I think that the very notion that sexuality is at the very center of a human person's being is a modern notion. Freud made this very important, obviously, so that everybody, all aspects of someone's psychology are linked up in things like their sexual desires, whether those sexual desires are conscious or unconscious or subconscious. And so there's a common sense in our world that sexuality, by that I mean not only just how you have sex, but your sexual desires and inclinations, all those are absolutely central to the formation of who a person is. And I don't think that was true for people in the ancient world. People in the ancient world, for example, didn't seem to think that you had to have sex to be happy, or that, for example, for men, masculinity was linked to having lots of sex. In fact, for a lot of ancient ideology, you were considered more masculine, at least by upper-class people, if you avoided sex entirely. So I think the centrality of sex and sexuality in the modern world wasn't there in the ancient world.
Okay, well, I mean, that's certainly an interesting historical observation. But let me see if this is right, though, on the first point about its relative lack of discussion in the Bible, and not at all by Jesus, that minimally it would suggest that there's no biblical basis for assuming, no matter what those verses say, that there's no biblical basis for assuming it's an especially bad sin, because if it were an especially bad sin, it ought to have had some more prominence, especially by a central figure in the religion.
Exactly. And even people, even scholars, for example, who are more conservative than I am and who would want to still say that Christianity should teach that homosexuality is a sin, even a lot of those scholars will point out that it's really not treated as a huge, important sin or a terrible sin, even in the places in the Bible where that they believe are talking about homosexuality. They'll point out, for example, that the New Testament especially has a lot more condemnations of things like wealth, rich people, or any kind of economic injustice. They'll point out, for example, that there's a lot more in the Bible about divorce, and so there's a lot more condemnation or prohibition of divorce. In fact, Jesus did say something about divorce, and so it's in the Gospels that Jesus forbade divorce for his followers. Or even disobeying one's parents is condemned more and more severely than anything that could conceivably be called homosexuality in the Bible.
Might want to come back later then and ask why then such the emphasis in so many churches. Let's turn to the second part, the question about the specific biblical passages, and let's look particularly in the New Testament, since those are often used. I know the people you mentioned, three, verses in Corinthians, verse in Timothy, which some people cite as showing that homosexuality is a particularly bad vice. And in fact, the language that some people use is identified as being somehow tied up with the fall of man.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, you think that's an incorrect reading of those verses, and I wonder if you can explain why.
Yeah, some people take the passage in Romans 1, where Paul is trying to convince Christians in Rome, and I think his main target there are Gentile Christians, that once upon a time, way back in history, all of humanity, except the Jews, sort of fell away from the proper knowledge of God. And some people will read that Romans 1 passage as being a reference to, say, the fall of in Eden, or Adam and Eve, or the traditional story of the eating of the forbidden fruit, and therefore a fall away from a perfect union with God into sin. And what they'll point out is that Paul doesn't really condemn homosexual behavior in Romans 1. That's not what he's writing for. In fact, what he does is he uses homosexual behavior as an example of a punishment that God gave to the Gentiles because, they say, of this falling away. Now, what I've tried to point out is that Paul really doesn't talk about Adam or Eve or the snake or Eden or any of those kinds of things in Romans 1. Paul does believe, I think, that sin came into the world through the sin of Adam. He talks about that in Romans 5. But in Romans 1, what I think he's talking about is how that there was a traditional myth, a Jewish myth in the ancient world, that at some point after Adam, and where you put this point was debated, everybody but the Jews became idolaters, and they turned away from the secure knowledge of the true God that all humanity at one time had, and they started worshiping and serving idols. Instead, they became polytheists instead of monotheists. And some ancient Jews believed that it was at that point in history that all sorts of bad things came into the world. Those bad things included things like warfare or the invention of weapons, violence, but they also included things that we might not consider so bad, like cosmetics or magic or things like that. Now, what I think Paul is doing is assuming that sort of Jewish myth, and what he's saying is that same-sex behavior, and he explicitly mentions men having sex with men, was a punishment given to the Gentiles by God as punishment for their polytheism and idolatry. Now, the reason that I think that's important is that most modern Christians don't really even know about that ancient Jewish assumption, and they probably don't believe it. In other words, most modern Christians probably don't believe that somewhere back there in history, all peoples of the nation of the world were monotheists, and then later they just kind of all at once, at one point in history, became polytheists, except for the Jews, and that's the origin of say paganism. I don't think most modern Christians believe that, which is why it's ironic to me that then they use Paul's narrative there in order to condemn homosexuality.
Tied up with that, I mean, part of what you're suggesting there has to do with the worldview that Paul had at the time, a worldview that we don't share.
Right.
I take it that's also tied up with the second problem you have with some of those verses, that many people interpret them as indicating that homosexuality is especially bad because it involves some sort of especially perverted desire.
Right. The modern kind of assumption is that normal desire, normal sexual desire, is heterosexual desire, and homosexual desire is abnormal. And in fact, some people will point to the Romans 1 passage and say this is where homosexual desire came from in the first place. But that's not what the passage says. The passage really, it talks about desire, but it seems to talk about simply desire in general. See, in the ancient, this is one of the ways that the ancient conception of sexuality is just so different from ours, and why it's a mistake to even talk about homosexuality in the modern sense as even existing in the ancient world. In the ancient world, the assumption was, especially for men, that men just had sexual desire, period. Actually, most of the ancient people believed that women had more sexual desire than men because they were weaker and couldn't control it. But they believed that, say, a man would just have sexual desire, and he might have that sexual desire for a woman or for a slave girl or for a boy or for a man or anybody. It was all kind of considered undifferentiated sexual desire for the ancients. Now, what some people believed was that some men just got kind of tired of sex with women, and in order to get more sex, they had this insatiable sexual desire. They got bored with women, and so they would try out sex with other men. But in that case, the idea was that homosexual activity, homosexual sex, was not an expression of a different kind of desire. It was just the same sort of desire taken to an extreme. It was just desire over the top. And so you find Roman or Greek philosophical moralists condemning homosexual sex. But the reason they condemn it is not because they think it's somehow a perverted desire. They believe that it's really excessive desire. It's an expression of excessive desire, and that men should kind of restrain their sexual desire and have sex with their wives.
And when you mean excessive desire, then it would be equivalent to gluttony.
Exactly. So, for example, in these philosophical texts, over and over again, when, say, Philo the Jew, who was a philosophically educated upper-class Jew in the first century, lived about the same time that Paul did, when he talks about this sort of thing, he says it's just like gluttons. It's just like people who their desire for food becomes so insatiable that they're not satisfied with a normal meal, so they have to search out strange delicacies, or they're not satisfied anymore. So they import snails from, you know, a far off region, or have cooks and chefs cook up very exotic dishes for them. And the philosophers, the Greek and Roman philosophers, would condemn this sort of behavior because they would say, "This, you're not keeping your desires within a normal boundary." And that's why when the ancient writers would call homosexual activity against nature, And they would say that. The Greek really means they are an excess of nature. They believe that nature had kind of produced a normal boundary both for eating and for sex. And bad kinds of sex, and here they would include either homosexual sex or maybe too much sex even with women, or say sex with beasts, any of those kinds of sex were condemned not because they were sort of against nature in the modern sense, but because they were in excess of the proper boundaries set by nature.
Okay, so the difference is that both might be unnatural in one way, that is, that they are either more than or different than the desire as it might be normally felt, but that's an important difference.
That's right. That's why, you know, when people in the modern world, even people who believe that homosexuality is a sin or that it's unnatural, most of them accept that there are simply people in the world who are oriented toward sex with people of their own sex. They have a homosexual orientation rather than a heterosexual orientation. And ever since the 19th century, in fact, there's been this sort of medical and scientific division, so that there are people who simply are, you know, heterosexual, and the people who are simply homosexual. And we might debate how they got that way. Were they born that way, or is it through things in their early lives or whatever? But no matter what, people tend to agree that there are just people who have homosexual orientation. There are other people who have heterosexual orientation, and some people in between. That whole orientation complex just didn't exist in that way in the ancient world. People in the ancient world recognized that there were some guys who tended to prefer having sex with young men, but they didn't put them into a separate category for that. That was like men who have a particular desire to have sex with blondes rather than brunettes. It was considered a matter of taste, and there were lots of differences in taste that were recognized, but it wasn't that people in the ancient world were divided up into heterosexual people and homosexual people.
Okay, the issue about desire, too, seems to me to be very, very interesting, given what I've read in some of your essays, that again, there's this very different understanding of desire between the ancient world and the modern world, and that Paul's account of desire seems to be different, really, than either, that he seems to think there's something bad about desire, period. Is that right? And if so, could you explain that?
Yeah, sort of. It's very complicated, so I hope I don't sound too confusing. There were lots of different scientists in the ancient world and philosophers who believed that desire, period, was bad. The Stoic philosophers, for example, really believed that any kind of desire, whether you're talking about desire for sex or desire for food or desire for fame or money, any desire they considered was bad because it meant a sort of loss of control of your will. And so they taught that if you were truly philosophically educated, you could get rid of any kind of desire completely. Now, the Stoics were a minority. Most people in the ancient world didn't believe that. So they were kind of a minority in that doctrine of theirs. But there are people who believe that all desires are kind of problematic in the ancient world. I don't think that's where Paul was. Paul, for example, can talk about desiring to see someone, or he desires other Christians in, you know, a purely kind of platonic way. And that's perfectly fine for Paul. But, interestingly enough, he never talks about sexual desire in a neutral or positive way like that. In fact, he only talks about sexual desire in, you know, about three, four places, maybe. And when he does, he seems to assume that any good Christian will not have sexual desire. He talks about it in 1 Corinthians 7, where he says that it's better to marry than to burn. And I think what's going on there is, by talking about burning, what Paul means is burning with desire. And in the ancient world, the metaphor of fire and burning was a common way to talk about sexual passion and desire. So Paul seemed to believe, I think, in 1 Corinthians 7, and I admit this is a rather controversial reading on my part, and some other scholars wouldn't agree with it, but I believe that it's clear that in 1 Corinthians 7, Paul teaches that Christians, if they need to get married, they should get married, but only to quench desire, not to satisfy desire. And in fact, the other place that Paul talks about desire in marriage, is sexual desire in marriage, is 1 Thessalonians, where he again says, you know, tells men, Christian men, to hold their wives. He uses a very funny Greek term, to kind of keep their wives as vessels and not to keep their wives in passion and desire like the Gentiles. So for Paul, I think he believed that sexual desire was simply excluded for Christians. It was a sign of the Gentile world out there that Paul believed was under the domain of Satan. Now, that's very odd, but there were other ancient people who believed that you could even get married and even have sex, but without experiencing sexual desire. And I believe that's what Paul believed.
All right, that seems to me to be tied up with something else that you talk about, that reflects a certain kind of derogatory view of women, that if the role of the woman is simply to stop the man from having sexual desire.
Yeah, that's very clear in that 1 Thessalonians passage where Paul actually uses the term, a thing or a vessel, and most scholars believe he is talking about wives there. And so there are indications that Paul didn't have exactly a liberated role of idea of the role of women that we might like that he had.
Well, now, how is this connected with his views that arguably concern homosexuality, where he talks in some of those verses about the sin of being effeminate?
Yeah, that's exactly right. In fact, we had talked. You had mentioned earlier the two passages, one in 1 Corinthians 6 and one in 1 Timothy 1, that some people say homosexuality is mentioned. And what I've disputed the translations of those Greek words, but one of those Greek words that some modern Bibles will translate as homosexual is the Greek word malakos, and it's in 1 Corinthians 6, 9. That word is pretty clear in what it means. It doesn't mean homosexual. It is a fairly common Greek word, meaning soft. But of course, what does soft mean in a list of vices or sins? It means clearly effeminate, because in the ancient world, the idea was the feminine side of things is the soft side of things. Women are soft, and it's proven by the fact that they are penetrated. And so the very heterosexual intercourse act itself demonstrated to people in the ancient world that women were porous and permeable and penetrated. And that carried connotations in the ancient world of softness. So I think that what Paul's condemning there with that use of the word malakos is any sort of effeminacy. Now, one of the things that shows is that that's implicated, obviously, misogyny. If something is bad because it's feminine, then that shows a corresponding devaluation, I believe, of women. And that's simply assumed in the ancient culture almost everywhere. The other problem with that, though, is, how are you going to translate that for a modern audience? We might, even if I could get scholars to agree that that word malakos doesn't mean homosexual in particular, it means effeminate, then what counts as effeminate? In Paul's world, a man could be called effeminate for scratching his head with one finger, for wearing cologne or aftershave, even for shaving itself. A man could be called effeminate for having sex with women too much, because that showed for some people a lack of manly control. So all sorts of things were considered effeminate in the ancient world that men would do that we wouldn't consider effeminate. So again, it just shows the radical differences in cultures from the culture that produced the Bible in these words and used them in one way, and then people who seem to want to translate them very quickly into the modern situation.
Okay, it's amazing to me that we're actually moving in toward finishing here. Let me just follow up on that last point, though. I mean, what you said is that the idea of homosexuality is not even mentioned that often in the Bible. It's not mentioned by Jesus at all. And that many of the verses where it is mentioned, there's at least question about some of them whether it in fact condemns homosexuality. And yet it does appear that for some number of Christians today, certainly not all, but for some number of Christians today, certain denominations, homosexuality seems to be picked out as an especially evil sin. How does that happen?
Well, I think that, for one thing, it's an expression of simply modern ideology's problems with homosexuality itself, and that's all wrapped up in the idea in the modern capitalist bourgeois state that depends so much on the reproducing nuclear family as part of its ideological makeup. So simply, homosexuality challenges the centrality of a heterosexual nuclear family as the only way to build a modern nation state, and that's part of the ideology of capitalism and the modern nation state. That's quite complicated, and we could go a long way over talking about why does the modern world in general have such a problem with, you know, all sorts of unusual sexual activity. I think, though, for modern Christianity, we can get a bit more exact, and I believe that modern churches are so exercised now about homosexuality because that is a sign of just how incoherent modern contemporary Christianity is about sex itself. Modern churches don't know what to do about sex, and they don't know what to do about the family. The family is having a lot of problems, a lot of pressures in our society for lots of different reasons. And it's clear to me that homosexuality is not the thing that's, you know, causing families to fall apart in our country or in Western Europe. But it becomes an easy target because it's something that people can grab onto as being, you know, obviously something that most people don't understand and don't like. I think, for example, that modern churches don't really know what to teach about divorce. As I said, Jesus is quite clear about prohibiting divorce, and the Catholic Church has tended to be clear about prohibiting it. But you have both Catholics and Protestants and churches that all over the place, there are tons and tons of divorced people in their churches. So what do they do about that? What about sex before marriage? What about sex outside of marriage? What about sex between two elderly people, both of whom have been married and don't want to get married again for various kinds of financial reasons? Is it wrong for these two people to be at all sexually active? There are lots of people like this, whether people know it or not, in churches, all kinds of churches. And I think that what it is that homosexuality is just the most controversial tip of the iceberg that shows that churches are going to have to figure out what they really are going to teach and believe about sex in general and its role in our lives, and about the family, what kind of family is going to be acceptable in the future.
Okay, we got 45 seconds. Mm. Sum up in any way you want, perhaps to talk about what you think the proper attitude ought to be, or just to sum up what you've mentioned so far.
I think the most important thing for me that I keep trying to say is to get people to think about the Bible in a different way. We've kind of been trained culturally to think of the Bible as sort of a rule book, that if we just kind of open it up and follow it, it's sort of like somebody's owner's manual for their lawnmower. If something goes wrong or if they need to know how many times to change the oil, they just kind of look it up. I think that's a very bad way to view the Bible. I think that Christians ought to think about the Bible much more as a source for inspiration and as a way to spark their imaginations to think about how they should live in the world, but not look at it as sort of, you know, what does the Bible say about X, Y, or Z? I think the Bible has to be approached differently than the way American Christians have traditionally approached it. And that way, when we talk about homosexuality or any other issue, abortion or the death penalty or wealth and poverty, we can use the Bible to inform our discussion, but we can't approach it like a rule book.
Okay, thank you very much for appearing on the show today.
Okay, thank you.
I've been speaking today with Dale Martin, professor of religion at Duke University. This is Hugh LaFollette, Fridays and Issues. Good day.